Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Chief Inspector Walter Dew of Scotland Yard, accompanied by two Quebec City police detectives, borrowed a uniform from a pilot boat officer and boarded the ocean liner now briefly docked at Canada's Pointe-au-Père. The English-speaking just call it Father Point. The captain of that vessel, the SS Montrose, had been told to stop at this two-bit way station in the middle of the St. Lawrence River and await instructions. Inspector Dew had tracked a murder suspect and his mistress as they tried to slip across the Atlantic to elude him. He was able to do this because 1910 was proving to be a freaking marvel of a year. Consider its newest technology, which was about to make worldwide news. Only 60 ships in the entire world had been outfitted with Guglielmo Marconi's innovative wireless telegraph technology, a breakthrough that allowed vessels to send and receive messages over long distances by radio. The ship the fugitives had boarded happened to be one of those 60, and its captain was a skilled seaman with impressive observational skills. After some stealthy conversations and a look around the suspect's cabin, he was sure that Dr. H.H. Crippen and his lover, Ethel Leneve, who was now disguised as a boy, were on board his ship. So, he wired Scotland Yard. The couple had registered as John Robinson and his 16-year-old son, John Jr. Inspector Walter Dew had been a young constable when Scotland Yard was hunting Jack the Ripper, and Dew had thought at the time that it was a monumental mistake not to include the press in on the chase. They had eyes and ears too, he figured. Use them. His stance hadn't changed in the intervening years. To that end, Dew had told the press that he was pursuing Dr. Crippen and his lover on a faster vessel, the White Star Line's SS Laurentic. He hoped to intercept them before they arrived in Quebec and slipped away into the crowd. Captain Henry Kendall's telegraphed tip was taken seriously. After that, he sent several messages daily to Montreal and London newspapers to report what Crippen and Leneve were up to and to keep Dew apprised of how soon he could catch up to them. Of course, those newspapers weren't delivered to the SS Montrose. In other words, pretty much the only two people in the world who did not know that Dew was about to arrest these two fleeing Londoners were the two fleeing Londoners and any other passengers aboard the Montrose. On July 31, 1910, Dew wore that pilot boatman's uniform and greeted Kendall as he stepped onto the captain's ship. Dew and his backups were escorted to the cabin assigned to the Robinsons. Their knock was answered and Kendall was about to begin introductions when Dew simply uttered, "Good morning, Dr. Crippen." The two men had met before while in Britain. And while accounts vary, it seems to be agreed that an astonished Crippen faltered first, then responded, "You have been very clever." Dew then explained Crippen was under arrest for the murder of his wife. Crippen is said to have replied, "I am not sorry." But not sorry for what? Not sorry he fled? Not sorry he'd been caught? Or not sorry he had, according to police, poisoned his wife, then cut her into tiny pieces and deposited a few of those under some loose bricks in his coal cupboard at their rented house at 39 Hilldrop Crescent in Camden. It's hard to say, but he would plead not guilty and maintain his innocence the rest of his life, so maybe it wasn't the last option. Or if it was, maybe he could explain. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Wayfair. Scott, here's some breaking news for you. I ordered a wicker storage piece for the upstairs hallway.
Why? What's wrong with the upstairs hallway?
Everything, Scott. Betty Lou's whole area up there is just chaos. Cat toys, cat food bags, cat supplies, all of it scattered everywhere.
Stuff's gotta go somewhere.
Agreed. I just prefer it not be on the floor, and that's why I'm excited I found this wicker storage piece on Wayfair that's going to corral all of it into one piece. I can't wait for it to show up.
That's the thing with Wayfair. You find quality materials that actually hold up to real life, not the stuff that falls apart in a season. Plus, Wayfair Rewards members get 5% back every day, so you're actually getting more value the more you shop.
And you can find options across a huge range of price points. You're not stuck choosing between style and staying on budget.
Wayfair also has 20 million verified 5-star reviews, real customer photos, and real feedback, so you know what you're getting before it shows up.
That's actually how I picked this piece. I read through a bunch of reviews, saw real photos of how people used it, and I knew it would fix our hallway.
Join Wayfair Rewards today to get 5% back on every purchase and start saving on your next home upgrade. Head to Wayfair.com to shop all things home. That's WAYFAIR.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home. Holly Harvey Crippen was born in Coldwater, Michigan in 1862 and became a homeopathic doctor who at various times claimed to be a gynecological specialist, an ear and eye man, and a dentist. He tended to get good jobs, even good teaching ones, but would be hastened on his way after a short while. His first wife, Charlotte, died in 1892 of a stroke. Their only child, a son, was handed off to Crippen's parents to raise. H.H. moved on. Those who have bothered to revisit Charlotte's death now find it a bit suspect. Here's Lindsay Civitar, a British historian who collects Crippen artifacts and plunged deeply into his backstory, speaking on an episode of Britain's Murder Map.
His first wife, Charlotte, they had a son together, Otto. Tragically, Charlotte died in 1892 from apoplexy, which is like a stroke, which is really intriguing because what basically makes a 33-year-old healthy lady suddenly die from a stroke. She was writing letters to her brother William saying, if I die, it's due to him.
Apparently, William did not pursue the matter. Crippen met the robust and ambitious music hall singer Corinne Turner about 2 years later. At the time, she was 17 and he was 30. Corinne, whom everyone called Cora, was actually born, bear with me here, as Kunigunda Makamotsky. The family changed their name to Turner, and she often used it. I'll note, too, that when she was a child, she took her stepfather's last name, Marsinger, sometimes spelled with an E as in Mersinger. P.S., I'm telling you this for future reference. Now, Cora would change her name again, for professional reasons and for the use of her stage friends, to Belle Elmore. For ease, we're just gonna call her Cora. How she met H.H. Crippen is only the first in a long list of varying accounts about the couple's lives together. Some stories would have them meeting as couples typically do, through mutual friends or maybe a backstage introduction between performer and admirer. Another story seems more credible once you dig deep enough. It seems that Cora was, at the time of their meeting, under the protection, that's in quotes, of an older man named C.C. Lincoln, who paid her bills. She was also a servant in the home he shared with his wife and children. Around this time, Dr. Crippen, always short on cash, performed abortions, which were far riskier in 1890s America than they are now, but just as illegal as they are in some states today. Cora became pregnant by Lincoln and either went to Crippen for an abortion or possibly for post-miscarriage care. She had a hysterectomy around 1895 that may have been connected. In any case, when Lincoln told Cora he wanted her to leave with him, Crippen stepped in and married her instead, saving her from the wanton existence of a kept woman. Gallantry wasn't dead. But 17 years later, Cora, like Charlotte, would be. And the now married couple moved around, first to Philadelphia, then Toronto, then to England, where Cora continued to nurture her theatrical career, which was, at best, as described by many, second rate. She could sing, but wasn't exactly a songbird. She could act, but she was no Sarah Bernhardt. Hallie Rubenhold, author of Story of a Murder about the Crippen case, explained to the History Nerds United podcast that
being an American in London made you quite an unusual person anyway. And then having a wife who was a performer, you know, you weren't really part of respectable society so much. You were on the fringes, and that kind of gave you a certain latitude. And the Crippens did find their own circle, and, you know, they were part of a kind of bohemian international set of people.
It's then that she met and fell in love with an American expat performer named Bruce Miller. Whether that relationship ever became intimate is debated even today. Miller swore it was just a deep, trusting relationship, albeit one in which he signed his letters to her, quote, with love and kisses to brown eyes, end quote. As you can tell, this is never going to be a totally straightforward tale, so I'll have to do a bit of couching. Now, supposedly it was this affair, this connection with Bruce Miller, that led to a cessation of marital relations and to separate bedrooms for the Crippens. Nevertheless, they maintained outward appearances. Now, the couple did not live in the most fashionable of neighborhoods, but their address at 39 Hilldrop Crescent was respectable enough. Cora, aka Belle, was seen by her friends as loyal, fun, hardworking, a good friend, a tough cookie, and charitable to a fault. She worked with the Music Hall Ladies Guild, a group founded in 1906 to support and give generously to female actresses, singers, and dancers who were struggling to feed their families or put roofs over their children's heads. Sure, it may have been a way for Cora to keep her hand in the business she loved but had, well, not exactly conquered. It was no secret she was quite bitter about that. But no one doubted her committed altruism. Most of her guild friends had been regularly entertained in her home and noticed the tension between Cora and her husband, sometimes saying that dining there was awkward. Cora seemed to go out of her way to diminish and browbeat her timid husband. Yes, Cora was loud, vibrant, and opinionated. Some even referred to her as blousy, which suggested a bit of an unkemptness about her. But she wasn't unkempt per se. She dressed well, loved jewelry, was not afraid of attention. Always a curvy woman, she had gained weight since being regularly on stage. She was fond of wild gesticulation as she talked. As for the good doctor, he was the wallflower in the corner, quiet, kind, mild-mannered, pleasant enough, but unremarkable company. When suspicion swirled later on, he was often referred to by friends and acquaintances as, quote, the last person you'd suspect of such a thing, end quote. He was smallish, at 5'3" or 5'4", lean and bespectacled. So, let's recap now. The Crippens were not well-suited and not sleeping in the same bed. But hey, who knows what goes on in any marriage, any relationship? People fill each other's gaps. Unusual pairings are, well, not that unusual. By 1910, the marriage had lasted 17 years. In England, Crippen's medical fortunes had faltered. He still did some dental work and, in order to supplement his income, had become a manager at Munyon's Remedies, a company which sold patent medicines via the mail. Most of the concoctions were overhyped and useless. So, yeah, he was a huckster, offering people a dram of this or a drop of that to cure everything from warts to grand mal seizures. Since about 1900, he worked at the Drury Institute for the Deaf, hoping, he would later say, to cure deafness. It was there he hired a young Ethel Leneuve as a typist. She was nothing like Cora, seemingly naive and reserved, deferential really, and she offered H.H. some much-needed attention. She was soon offering him more. The couple took regular time off to be together for private dinners and some respite in hotel rooms. When she told him she couldn't refer to him as Dr. Crippen anymore, he asked her what her father's name was. She told him it was Peter. He liked that name and took it on, even answering to it with other people. As the relationship between Ethel and H.H. blossomed, the dutiful husband still found time to entertain his and Cora's bohemian friends, too. So, there was nothing unusual about January 31st, 1910, when the married couple hosted a dinner party at their home. Those in attendance were theater friends, so the topics hovered around the London shows and gossip among the trade. In Birishwar Chakraborty's book, The Buried Truth, the author refers to Cora by her stage name Belle. He writes that on that evening, quote, "Belle spoke of America again. America represented both origin and unfinished promise. She described opportunities that might have been seized, audiences that might have been larger, managers who might have been less provincial than London's," end quote. As the night wore on, quote, she joked, lightly, publicly, about her husband's cautious management of money. The humor landed unevenly, end quote. The evening continued without obvious rancor. Later, one of Crippen's guests, Clara Martinetti, would say it was the happiest party imaginable, so much so that she and her husband did not leave until 1:30 in the morning. And yet, after that party, no one in attendance ever saw Cora again. At first, no one took notice. There had been no screams heard from the house, no slamming of doors, no unusual comings and goings. In fact, on February 1st, the day after the party, Dr. Crippen showed up at the Martinetti home to check on Clara's husband, who had complained of a cold the night before. When asked how Cora was, he said she was fine. Within a few days of that, the Ladies Guild secretary received a note from Cora saying she had decided to go to America on short notice to tend to a sick relative and figured she'd be gone for a few months. She regretfully resigned her post as guild treasurer. When Clara Martinetti saw H.H. again, he dropped in to check on her husband's health. She said she would send word to their mutual friends in New York and have Cora check in. H.H. then told Clara that Cora was bypassing New York and was going straight to California. The ladies at the Ladies Guild grew concerned. It had been weeks, and there had been no word from their voluble and social friend. Then they noticed that Ethel Lenev had moved into the Crippen home at 39 Hilldrop Crescent. She also began to show up in public with Cora's husband, dressed in Cora's furs and wearing Cora's bespoke jewelry. The ladies of the Ladies Guild could not stand idly by. They hired a private investigator. He found that H.H. had pawned some jewelry on February 2nd and was wearing a black hat and a black armband, the kind to indicate mourning, when he returned to work. Other than that, the Dick had nothing much else to report. It had been almost 2 months since Cora had last been seen. Then, on March 20th, the Martinettis opened a letter from H.H. that explained he had just received a cable from Cora saying she was dangerously ill, having contracted double pleuropneumonia. 4 days later, he followed up with a telegram telling them that Belle died yesterday at 6 o'clock. He added that he was going straight away to California. Clara rushed to 39 Hilldrop Crescent. H.H. was still there. He told her that his wife had died in Los Angeles and was to be cremated. Appalled now, the ladies of the Ladies Guild were going to take their suspicions to Scotland Yard. There, one of their number, Louise Smithson, spoke to a Chief Inspector Dew, who frankly told them they had no evidence to go on. Well, fine, they would find some. They pored over the manifests of ships leaving London around the 1st of February. They contacted Crippen's long-forgotten son, Otto, who lived in Los Angeles. He wrote that he had no knowledge of his stepmother having recently been in town. He said he'd gotten word from his father she had died in San Francisco. The ladies then wrote the LA Chamber of Commerce and found that no one named Cora Crippen, or even Belle Elmore, had died there that March. By now, an obituary for Cora had appeared in London theater industry newsletters paid for by her husband. When the ladies of the Ladies Guild returned again to press their case to Chief Inspector Dew on June 30th, 5 months after Cora had last been seen, he said, okay, he'd make some inquiries. He would start at 39 Hilldrop Crescent. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by ButcherBox. Have you ever opened the fridge, stared into it for 5 minutes, and somehow convinced yourself there's nothing to eat?
That's why ButcherBox has become part of our routine. There's always something good in the freezer.
I've been trying to prioritize protein more lately, and it's so much easier when quality options are already sitting there ready to cook instead of scrambling last minute.
ButcherBox has 100% grass-fed beef, organic chicken, wild-caught seafood, all sourced responsibly to standards they can actually explain. They've done the hard sourcing work already, so all you have to do is decide what's for dinner.
And every box is customizable to fit how you actually eat.
We've used it for grilling with friends. Well, we've bought it for other people to grill. We never did become grill masters this summer.
We ran out of time. School started Thursday. There's no time for anything anymore.
Nope. That's why it's nice to keep the freezer stocked, so there's one less thing to worry about.
If you're looking for an easier way to get great meals on the table, give ButcherBox a try.
Go to butcherbox.com/COTC to get $20 off your first box, plus your choice of free ground beef for life, or free chicken thighs or top sirloins in every box for a year, with free shipping always.
That's butcherbox.com/COTC.
Again, that's butcherbox.com/COTC. Be sure to use our link so they know we sent you.
Ethel Leneve was home when Inspector Dew and his detective sergeant came calling. Obviously miffed, and wearing some bling that had previously been owned by Cora, she told Dew that Crippen wasn't home and he'd have to come back some other time. Dew asked her to come with him to Crippen's office. He didn't want Ethel calling ahead to warn HH about the impending visit. He shouldn't have worried. Crippen was ready for him and would quickly, and without much prompting, explain that, yeah, he'd made up all that stuff about Cora's dying. While the chief inspector found the young woman to be nervous and vaguely uncooperative, he found Crippen to be calm, guileless, and helpful. He took a statement from Crippen, a multi-page life story encompassing tome that explained he had done all that because he was embarrassed over having been deserted by his wife. As per D.S. Arthur Mitchell's dictation, Crippen said, quote, "She frequently threatened to leave me and said that if she did, she would go right out of my life and I should never see or hear from her again. On that Monday night of the dinner party, she did say one thing, which she had never said before, that I was to arrange to cover up any scandal with our mutual friends in the guild the best way I could," end quote. He acknowledged as well his 3-year affair with Miss Leneve, whose real surname, by the way, was just Neve. She added the le and the French flair of her own volition, though he believed Cora to have now taken up with Bruce Miller in Chicago, so, you know, they were even. He invited Dew and Mitchell into the house on Hilldrop Crescent to look around. He went with them as the men from Scotland Yard found the house in good order, with pictures of Cora still prominently placed throughout. They went to the garden and into the coal cellar, which, it should be noted, was not in the basement, but in a small anteroom adjacent to the small breakfast room on the first floor. It was dusty and looked undisturbed. They found nothing untoward. When the two lawmen were leaving, Crippen told them he intended to buy an advertisement in a few big American newspapers asking Cora to contact him. He wanted nothing more than to clear this whole business up. No one is certain what happened when Crippen wished the two men a good evening and closed the door. We do know that Dew went home and had a bad feeling about the whole thing. Something was amiss, but what? On Monday, July 11th, when Dew and Mitchell made a second unannounced visit to the Hilldrop house, HH and Ethel were gone. At one of Crippen's places of work, the doctor had informed a partner that he was going to be absent now, in order to escape trouble. Dew alerted domestic and foreign ports to be on the lookout. He circulated flyers in and around London seeking information about their whereabouts. Dew and Mitchell returned to the house to look again. The maid and housekeeper let them in on July 12th. Again, they came up empty. Then, on July 13th, the pair went again to the coal cupboard and, on their hands and knees, started poking at bricks with a poker. They located a loose brick and, loosening it further, found they could dig out what was underneath. They got down just a few inches when the smell of decaying flesh hit them. Dew would later recount his luck in finding that whoever had covered the flesh had made an error that aided the police. They had mixed slime with water, and instead of hastening the decay, they crudely preserved it. Dr. Thomas Marshall, the police surgeon, was called, as were Dew's bosses, who came around that evening to watch what came out of the ground. At first, it didn't make much sense. They found small chunks of flesh, one which had a visible striation on it. There was a stomach, devoid of any contents. There was a hair curler around which there were twisted both brown and blonde hair. There was also some patterned cloth, some string, a rotted knotted handkerchief, and some ladies' undergarments mixed in. There was no head, no legs, no arms, no skeleton, no sexual organs, or any remnant of anything that could indicate whether the body was male or female. The only sizable piece of flesh unearthed had been cut out in one single piece, and it included chunks of the liver, the stomach, the windpipe, both lungs, the heart, the kidneys, the pancreas and spleen, and some of the large intestine. Which sounds like a lot, but really it wasn't. The clues were scant, but Dew was able to find a box under one of the beds that contained two complete pairs of men's pajamas and one pair of pajama bottoms, the fabric matching some that had been found with those body parts. Those had been turned over first to Dr. Marshall, then to Dr. Bernard Spilsbury, a young forensic pathologist who would soon become so renowned as to be dubbed the father of modern forensic science. But that would come later. In 1910, Spilsbury was just 33, working at St. Mary's Hospital in London, a man who confidently believed that he was among the few who could correctly interpret what the dead were trying to tell him. He went to work. Dew did the same, though his focus was on the living. He had to find Crippen and Leneve. Unbeknownst to him, the pair had hightailed it to Antwerp and got two tickets to Quebec in the names of John Robinson and son. They had cut Ethel's hair, bought her some ill-fitting menswear, told anyone who asked that the boy was deaf and had a throat infection, so there was no use talking to him. The pair boarded the Montrose and set sail on July 20th. Captain Kendall had, as was his custom, bought an international edition of the Daily Mail to read at his leisure and watched as his 266 passengers boarded his steamship. As he later explained to the BBC in 1930,
"Behind a lifeboat, I saw two men. One was squeezing the other's hand. I walked along the boat deck and got into conversation with the elder man. I noticed that there was a mark on the bridge of his nose through wearing spectacles, that he had recently shaved off a mustache, and that he was growing a beard. I returned to my cabin and, taking out a London newspaper, studied the descriptions and photographs issued by Scotland Yard of Crippen."
Then he ordered that every newspaper on board be surreptitiously confiscated by his crew so that no other passenger would remark aloud on the resemblance and spook the pair. While papers were disappearing on board, as I said before, the captain took it upon himself to enter their cabin, I'm guessing that's okay if you're the captain, and found women's undergarments in the boys' luggage. He then became a veritable Sherlock Holmes.
"I returned to the dining saloon and sat next to Robinson. The boys' manner at the table was ladylike. Later, when they were promenading the saloon deck, I went out and walked behind them and called out, 'Mr. Robinson.' As I had expected, I had to shout the name several times before the man said to me, 'I'm sorry, Captain, I didn't hear you.' In the next 2 days, we developed our acquaintance. Mr. Robinson was the acme of politeness, quiet-mannered, a non-smoker. At night, he went on deck and roamed about on his own. Once the wind blew up his coattails, and in his hip pocket I saw a revolver. After that, I also carried a revolver."
The captain had, by then, also sent that Morse-coded message to Scotland Yard, and Chief Inspector Dew had booked himself immediate passage on the Laurentic out of Liverpool. The long arm of the law had just gotten considerably longer. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Mint Mobile.
When we were kids, summer meant freedom. No homework, no teachers, no school.
And as adults, summer still means freedom, thanks to Mint Mobile's summer sale. Right now, all of Mint's plans are $15 a month, even unlimited.
So free yourself from big wireless and all their gimmicks and gotchas and switch to Mint for high-speed data and coverage on the T-Mobile 5G network.
My friend John's been on Mint Mobile for a while now, and he talks about it all the time. He swears by how easy the switch was and how much he's saving.
And you can bring your current phone and your number, so you don't have to start from scratch.
Choose from 3, 6, or 12-month plans and say goodbye to a monthly bill.
Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile. It's so easy. Sign up online and get 3 months of premium wireless for $15 a month.
To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/COTC. That's mintmobile.com/COTC. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/COTC. That's it. There's no catch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12 months. Plan required, $15 per month equivalent. Taxes and fees extra. Initial plan term only. Greater than 50 gigabytes may slow when network is busy. Includes up to 20 gigabyte hotspot. Capable device required. Availability, speed, and coverage varies. See mintmobile.com.
Now, you know how the arrest of Dr. Crippen and Leneuve went, so I'll skip that retelling. Dew promptly informed Scotland Yard that he'd gotten his man and the man's mistress. The public was duly informed as well, and Dew would soon recognize that while the Ripper had been an English story that America cared about, this was a story the whole world cared about. By the time the Montrose arrived in Quebec on August 1st, at least 500 people were waiting dockside to catch a glimpse of the hero cop and his catch. And think the O.J. Simpson Bronco Chase, 1910 style, already making headlines across the world. While still waiting to get his charges back to British soil, Dew was disinclined to give much to the media. Pro tip, media folk don't like when that happens. And so Dew was hounded, he would later say, at his hotel, at meals, and his every waking hour to offer some tidbit about the case. In lieu of real information, the public was fed a regular diet of fables dished by those with only the vaguest connections to the case. Though some tips were legit, Ethel's father, believing his daughter innocent, quickly sold her story to pay her impending legal bills. Dew was furious about all of it, but didn't have the time to refute every bogus report. He was, for his part, trying to book a way back for the fugitives, trying to keep a watchful eye on Crippen, whom he considered a suicide risk, and insisting that the pair be kept apart for the duration of the voyage. When the first court hearing took place in Canada, some 3,000 people were on hand. The press reported they were all women, trying to gain entrance. Yet there were only about 40 seats. The crowd was reportedly surprised to see that Crippen was so slight and wore glasses, hardly the monster they had imagined, and yet they were certain he was guilty of this monstrous act. Dew would later write in his own autobiography entitled I Caught Crippen that the animosity toward Crippen actually surprised him. Quote, it was the same the world over. I've never known anything like it. Only those who can remember the case and the intense excitement and bitterness it engendered can have any conception of the widespread antipathy toward the little man who was now in my charge, end quote. This concerned Dew, who was worried about the fairness of the trials ahead. Historian and filmmaker Johnny Owen, who with his partner Vicky McClure hosts Britain's Murder Map, explains.
We think it's a modern thing, you know, hacking phones and sort of following people and gardens with long net lenses. This would have been the same then. If you read this, then, you know, you're definitely biased about what's happened because you would have heard about it because everybody was, it was the most famous story in the world. If you already remember, you're going to have an opinion. That tool trial by media thing was a huge part of this. I couldn't agree more. For me, it's the decision's been made. He's guilty before he's tried.
Back on Hilldrop Crescent, the search for more evidence continued. Police tore apart the rest of the coal cupboard, looked in nearby sewers and dustbins and in adjacent gardens amid throngs of looky-loos and tourists who came to share the excitement and grab any souvenir at hand. Back at the yard, Dr. Augustus Pepper was sorting out the putrid remnants left in the hole at number 39. As he explained to a magistrate's court in early September, the largest chunk showed signs of real surgical expertise. Also, one of the chunks of flesh bore the signs of a scar, like one would expect to see post-surgery. In that same court, Dr. William Wilcox, a revered toxicologist, testified that he had found traces of a poison in all the organs he had looked at and, on further examination, determined the substance to be hyoscine of the nightshade family. He said it was present in what would be considered extremely large amounts if it had been ingested for medical reasons, such as to quiet delirium. He said the drug had been taken orally and would have incapacitated a person within an hour of ingestion, making them paralyzed and comatose before death. Police were able to track down a purchase of hyoscine made by Crippen a few months before his wife's disappearance. The amount he bought would have been typical for 500 medicinal doses of the drug. The result of the inquest was that Crippen could be tried for the crime. Lenev could be tried separately for complicity to murder. Justice was swift. Crippen's trial opened on October 18, 1910. Despite his BS cover story about Cora dying, just kidding, she left me, Crippen claimed total innocence. The prosecutor had what he considered to be an overabundance of evidence. In fact, he'd later say he hadn't had to use it all. Most importantly, the case hinged on what was found in the coal cupboard and on the jury's willingness to trust forensic pathology, a discipline barely out of its infancy in 1910, to identify a few scraps of flesh as Cora's remains. Early on, the field's success in criminal cases didn't depend just on the science. It depended on the ability of the scientists to sell what they knew. And while the gore factor was high in this case, pathologist Spilsbury had been rock solid in his convincing certainty about the chunk of flesh with the scar. It was proof of the identity of the partial corpse. See, remember, Cora Crippen had once had a hysterectomy, which left a scar. Spilsbury said the scar definitively identified the corpse as hers. Crippen said, no way, the body wasn't Cora's. It must have been there, buried beneath the bricks, before he and Cora ever moved in. To that, Scotland Yard countered that the material used in the pajama top found with the remains had only been manufactured after November 1908. Now, the defense tried a lot, but they didn't try everything. For example, they didn't bring up the fact that the stomach found with the flesh pieces was empty. Cora had actually eaten a full dinner and had after-dinner drinks on the night she was allegedly killed, and no trace of that was found. Whether it would have changed the outcome, we can't know. The trial lasted 5 days. The jury took just 27 minutes to find Crippen guilty. He was sentenced to death by hanging. All throughout, he had insisted that Ethel Leneuve was blameless, and he knew that because he had told her Cora had left him and, soon after, died in California. Authorities weren't convinced, so they tried her anyway. The trial began and ended on October 25, 1910. After just 20 minutes of deliberation, Ethel was found not guilty, which some people question in hindsight. Author Rubenhold again.
Ethel was quite, you know, she was the new woman at the time. She earned her own income. She eventually lived independently from her parents. She had sex outside of marriage, which was really shocking. I mean, this is all part of this scandal.
For what it's worth, after all his dealings with her, Dew thought that the correct verdict was reached. Crippen was executed on November 23rd. He left everything to Ethel. It's often been asked what would have happened if he and Ethel had not decided to go on the lam, if they had just waited it out, if the three previous searches of the house on Hilldrop Crescent would have been deemed enough. Had their absconding convinced Dew they had something to hide? Almost a year after Crippen's death, Leneuve was found to have forged Cora's name on some bank withdrawals, but thinking the poor girl had been through enough, no criminal charges were filed against her. That had been just after Lloyd's Weekly News published Leneuve's story in four Sunday installments with vivid illustrations. The series was done with her cooperation. In fact, she would sell her story three more times in the coming decades. Each of them told a different version of her post-Crippen life. As author Rubenhold told the History Nerds,
Ethel plays the wilting violet. Ethel is no wilting violet. I mean, Ethel is devious. Well, she's very ambitious. And when Ethel sees what she wants, she goes for it. And nothing will stop her. And she is remorseless as well. She's a remorseless person.
Truth was, she married a man named Smith, whom she told of her past. They had two children who had no idea of their mother's history until after she died in 1967. Over the past 100 years or so, a few kinks have appeared in the case against Crippen. The things that intrigue me the most? Why would Crippen bury chunks of random parts when he had somehow successfully managed to discard the big stuff, like the head, the arms, the legs? Why bury an 11 by 9 inch length of skin complete with subcutaneous fat, or a piece of back and buttocks that was even smaller? Why take that small piece of abdomen with the identifiable scar? I'm not alone in my questions. Here are two voices that agree, beginning with Andrew Rose, an author and historian.
If I were defending Crippen, I would make great play on the fact that the alleged murderer had disposed of large quantities of the body in some other way, and yet left a filleted section in his own house. Very strange thing to do, to leave incriminating material together, of course, with items of your own clothing.
If we understand what's not in this grave, he had to be hauling body parts somewhere in town, into a canal or somewhere to get rid of it. A head, his wife's head, etc., limbs. And these are little pieces left over. And I don't understand why not just get rid of them too. And that's no evidence.
That second voice was John Trestrail, an internationally recognized forensic toxicologist and the author of the seminal textbook, Criminal Poisoning Investigational Guide for Law Enforcement, Toxicologists, and Attorneys, speaking on the PBS series Secrets of the Dead.
I kept coming back saying, something's not right. Something's wrong in here. We're not understanding. I have murdered and dismembered my wife and disposed of 99% of her body. Why do I leave 1% of it under the coleslaw?
And why do that when the method of homicide was poison of all things? And the whole point of poisoning someone is to make the death look natural.
The thing that keeps me coming back to this Crippen case is the dismemberment of the body. It does not make sense to dismember one's victim. This is the only case I know of where the victim was dismembered. A poisoner attempts to get a natural death certificate signed and walk away from the crime.
And what about that pajama top? He was known to have burned things in his yard on a regular basis. Why not throw in the top, or the string, or the curlers? You know, the house had been thoroughly searched three times before. Yet when Dew and Mitchell returned, without other officers and with Crippen on a boat in the middle of the Atlantic, the coal cupboard suddenly yields its gross goodies? Was it just good police work? Was Crippen just a dumb criminal? Or was this so-called open and shut case neither open nor shut? Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Home Chef. Scott, with school starting back up, our whole routine's about to shift again.
It really does throw everything off. Suddenly, there's less time in the evenings for anything, let alone cooking.
Which is why I'm leaning on Home Chef even more right now. I'm actually hoping to spend a little more time cooking fresh at home this fall, and having everything planned out makes that so much more doable.
That's the whole point. Fresh food delivered, easy recipes to follow, and it actually tastes great.
No long shopping lists, no complicated prep, and the cleanup's super easy. And it's not one size fits all. Over 30 meal options every week, different tastes, different dietary needs, including calorie conscious and GLP-1 friendly meals.
The GLP friendly ones come pre-proportioned with dietitian approved nutrition guidelines. High protein, high fiber, built for fullness and blood sugar stability without losing flavor.
People really do love it. Home Chef's rated number one by users of other meal kits for quality, convenience, value, taste, and recipe ease.
For a limited time, Home Chef is offering our listeners 50% off and free shipping for your first box, plus free dessert for life. Go to homechef.com/COTC.
That's homechef.com/COTC for 50% off your first box and free dessert for life.
Homechef.com/COTC. Must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert.
Before our last act here, you should know that after Crippen, Bernard Spilsbury goes on to become a forensic god. He's knighted in 1923 when he's just 46. His courtroom appearances are downright legendary. He also probably saved us all when he helped British intelligence fool the Axis powers into thinking they were invading Greece in 1943, when they were instead planning on invading Sicily to gain access to the European continent. I digress, but this is all to convey how highly regarded Sir Bernard was, is, in part because he could sell his expertise as irrefutable. He told Crippen's jury, "I have no doubt that the scar he saw in the flesh patch was definitively Cora's, that it was what those now in the biz call a distinguishing mark acquired during Cora's hysterectomy 15 years earlier." The defense countered with the testimony of Dr. Gilbert Turnbull, who explained to the jury that he didn't think it was a scar at all, but a reddish mark that was the result of the skin having been folded. And Turnbull was no piker. He was the director of the Pathological Institute at the London Hospital. He testified that, on close examination, the so-called scar contained hair follicles and sebaceous glands, something scar tissue can't regrow. Trials often delve into a battle of the experts, and this war, the jury sided with Spilsbury. The specimens still reside at the Royal London Hospital Museum and Archives, so do Dr. Turnbull's drawings of the layers visible on the reddish mark. Here's Michigan State University's David Foran speaking in 2008 when he was the director of the university's forensic biology unit.
There are several slides at the museum. Three or four of those represent the so-called scar. Other ones represent what are labeled as folds in the skin. Visually, I doubt that any of us could look at those and differentiate them. So it seems quite possible that Dr. Spilsbury found what he wanted to find.
And really, who could prove him wrong? Cora was never heard from again after January 31st, 1910. Dr. Crippen had never confessed, instead insisting that, despite how it looked, he had not killed Cora. In the early 2000s, Trestrail, the poison guy, was intrigued by the case. It was, to his knowledge, the only case in which hyoscine was used as an agent of death. Yes, Crippen bought the medicine, he said so. But Trestrail wondered how Dr. Wilcox, in 1910, knew to look for this alkaloid poison in the first place. Because to the 21st century poison guy, that would be a giant leap even now. Trestrail set out to first find Cora. What he found in the British National Archives was a report from the Metropolitan Police about how Cora had tried to withdraw her life savings just 2 weeks before she disappeared. There's no evidence the defense was aware of this. Trestrail also says he found two sisters living together in the United States, one named Belle Rose, the other named Bertha Mersinger. Belle Rose's profession, per the U.S. Census, was listed as singer. Bertha was the name of Cora's sister, and Mersinger, if you recall me hinting earlier, was a variation of their stepfather's last name. And one more thing, Belle Rose had immigrated to the United States from England in August 1910. I don't know, I'll admit it's odd. Now, Trustrail decided he would get himself some of the preserved tissue and see what DNA analysis could do to solve the riddle. He hypothesized that the found flesh was the result of some ill-fated abortion performed by Crippen that had gone wrong. It made some sense. To prove or disprove that notion, Trustrail had to hunt down someone who might share mitochondrial DNA with Cora. He found a distant female relative, Marie Hamill, as well as her sister and daughter to contribute their spit. A quick refresher with the long-standing caveat, I'm no scientist. Mitochondrial DNA is passed from mother to child. It does not undergo change and mutates very, very slowly, so slowly that geneticists use it to trace ancient human migration patterns and such. If Marie's matched the sample, it was Cora in the coal cupboard. In 2007, after much to-do getting access to a slide as prepared by Spilsbury, Trustrail submitted it all to Foran at MSU. Foran put the samples into his highly sophisticated spinner and sifter and waited for Cora to pop out. The first thing that he did was see that several markers on the mDNA did not match Hamill's. Foran ran more tests. To his astonishment, he found the 1910 slide specimens were not only likely not from Cora, they were male. News got out and the forensic world shook. Could Crippen have been wrongly executed? Well, let's step back a minute. If that sample had been handled hundreds of times since it left its owner, it had been in the ground, touched by cops, doctors, lawyers, and who knows all, they could have left their own DNA on it. Foran disagrees on that point.
Even though it's a very thin slice of tissue, there's a lot of material there from whoever's body that was. And if someone had touched that sample to process it, the amount of DNA that they would have left behind would be minuscule. DNA from tissue on the slide would have swamped out any material that may have been left by pathologists.
Foran's work was published in the journal Forensic Science in January 2011, giving it scientific heft. Now, I feel like I have to note this because I don't want you to think I'm not aware. Foran later was dismissed from MSU in 2019 after he was found to have violated the sexual misconduct policy for inappropriate touching. But back to his Crippen case findings. No one was sure what to think of all this. No one, except the very distant relatives of Holly Harvey Crippen, who petitioned the British government in 2008 to pardon their beloved relation and repatriate his body to the United States. So, this 20th century crime of the century lives on, seeping over into the 21st. Just last year, in 2025, Jack Blackburn reported in the Times of London that Professor Turi King, the geneticist who confirmed the identity of Richard III from bones found under a London car park, disputed the Michigan lab's DNA findings from 18 years earlier. To start with, King said that historical DNA is very damaged and had usually been contaminated many times over. Secondly, the professor explained, the tests were done on a single sample and in a single laboratory, where it's standard practice for historical DNA to be tested in at least two. And in a final dig at Trustrail's methodology, the MSU lab is not accustomed to doing historical analysis. The British government quickly found no reason to pardon Crippen and hasn't changed its mind. Besides, it said in its reply to the distant relatives, you are too distant to count. The implication, of course, from all of this DNA hubbub was that Dew and Mitchell had planted the flesh in the pajama top, establishing the who and the when of the Crippen crime. Here's Matthew Conyum, author of Mr. Crippen, Cora, and the Body in the Basement, speculating about how that happened.
The police were absolutely certain that Crippen was guilty, but they immediately saw that they were going to have a problem making it stick. because what they had in terms of physical remains, if not completely unidentifiable, then extremely difficult to identify. And so the game then became to make this stick. So you see a lot of consciously or otherwise confirmation bias in the investigation, and all of it being played out in public via the newspapers.
All of that is true. So is the fact that the British Home Secretary, then a man named Winston Churchill, had asked to stay informed of the progress of the case, putting even more pressure on the police to get their man. If there's more to learn, we wait to hear it. But it's been interesting in all this to find that the real heroes of the day weren't Dewar Spillsbury or even Trestrail, if he's right. The real heroes, at least as I and a few others see it, are the ladies of the Ladies Guild. Author Hallie Rubenhold spoke to The Times in 2025. She said, quote, "The problem with historical true crime is we're just repeating legend. Nobody ever really examines what was said, and a lot of people saying these things and telling their story were all men," end quote. Remember, it was the guild members who, early on, demanded Scotland Yard to investigate. British historian Fern Riddell said Chief Inspector Dew's initial response was predictable.
"It is just another example of ignoring the women and women's stories and voices and their testimonies and who they were. Sometimes people are just bad.
Yeah.
Sometimes people just do terrible things. And the echoes of that still sit with us today."
The so-called ladies didn't accept that. They didn't take no for an answer, piling through ship manifestos to see if Cora had boarded any American-bound ship, writing letters to American actresses familiar with Cora to be on the lookout. They were also the ones who defended Cora when the almost all-male media and prosecutorial depictions of her were less than flattering. Here's Murder Map's Vicky McClure on how Cora was described in Filson Young's book, The Trial of Holly Harvey Crippen, published in 1920.
"He made her out to be really filthy, not very clean, you know, wasn't quite keeping up to scratch with the housework. He describes Cora's talent as inadequate. She was not that good at her job, as in, you know, she wasn't that great a performer, and she didn't have a scrap of ability, and just wanted to wear nice costumes, really."
To her friends, though, she was a generous and heroic woman who, maybe because of her own experience with men like C.C. Lincoln, and maybe because of her abortion or miscarriage and hysterectomy, knew how cruel her chosen field could be. Without those friends, without their belief that she had been the victim of the worst kind of domestic violence, Cora, aka Belle, would have just been another actress with a bad marriage who gave up and went home. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson read Nicholas Connell's Dr. Crippen, the infamous London cellar murder of 1910, and Bireswar Chakraborty's The Buried Truth, Dr. Crippen, the Stolen Life of Belle Elmore and the 2025 Verdict. She also read excerpts from Hallie Rubenhold's Story of a Murder, The Wives, The Mistress, and Dr. Crippen. She found the BBC's interview archive to be a freaking marvel, and newspapers of the day, as they reported the chase across the Atlantic, to be downright fascinating. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're @centuriespod. And you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.